Good morning. I'm Connor Thomas, filling in for Leslie on the Local News Hour, Thursday, May 21st. News time is 8:06. There is one crash that UDOT is reporting in the Wasatch back. That is in Charleston on 189 eastbound. So that's coming back into Heber from the Deer Creek area. It is on the right shoulder. It appears to not be blocking any lanes just as you begin the straightaway after that quite dangerous curvy section of road by the reservoir. So take care as you go through there, but it looks like it's not causing any delays. We, of course, have our usual morning queues at certain exits and River Road on North 40. Other than that, there is nothing much traffic to report. It is 50 degrees in Old Town, 44 in the Heber Valley. More weather from ABC meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back. We're going to be tracking the chance of a few isolated showers and maybe a rumble of thunder as we go throughout the day across the Wasatch back. A weak front is moving through the northern half of the state, but it's basically just grazing us. We're on the southern end of that front as the main moisture and energy is well to our north in the portions of Montana and near the Canadian border. But again, keep the rain gear close by. We will have some passing showers and maybe a rumble of thunder. It will keep our temperatures a little cooler today with highs only in the upper 50s in Park City. We'll see those highs in the low to mid 60s in the Heber Valley. As we make our way into your Friday, we'll start to dry things back out once again. We'll call it a mixture of sun and clouds, so partly cloudy skies. Temperatures starting off around the freezing mark, but we'll see those numbers climbing into the low 60s there for us in the afternoon in Park City with highs in the upper 60s in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Memorial Day weekend, I've got some fantastic weather on the way. Mostly sunny skies expected for your Saturday with high temperatures climbing into the low 70s in Park City. We'll be in the mid to upper 70s for highs in the Heber Valley. High temperatures continue to climb so that by Sunday we're seeing those highs in the mid 70s in Park City. We'll have those high temperatures climbing into the low 80s in the Heber Valley. And for your Memorial Day itself, it looks plenty of sunshine with just a few high clouds. We'll see those temperatures staying on the warm side with highs in the mid 70s in Park City and highs in the low 80s in the Heber Valley. As we head into next week, once we get past your Memorial Day, there's actually going to be a system that's going to move by to our north. Doesn't like it's going to have a ton of moisture with it, but what it will do is it will pick up our winds, combining that with some dry air, so that'll elevate the fire danger across the Wasatch back as we go into your Tuesday and the Wednesday. It will start to cool our temperatures down as well, with highs dropping from the 70s into the 60s by Wednesday in Park City and highs dropping from the 80s into the low 70s by Wednesday in the Heber Valley. And again, mainly dry with just an isolated shower chance on Wednesday. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch back on ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Thank you to Cedric. And coming up later in the broadcast today, we'll be checking in with Summit County Councilmember Chris Robinson about the county council meeting last night, and Park City School District Superintendent Lindsay Huntsman and the Board of Education VP Nick Hill. And rounding the hour with an interview from Utah Highway Safety Office Deputy Director Carrie Furr on the 100 deadliest days of summer on the roads, that and Memorial Day traffic. We should note, Summit County is a financial supporter of this radio station. And we did experience some technical difficulties yesterday on our digital streams on our app and kpcw.org. I'm pleased to report that that is fixed, but if you do experience any static or issues on that, let me know at 435-655-8255, and we can get that sorted out. But we should be up on all streams, including, of course, our radio frequencies. This Thursday on Cool Science Radio, coming up after the local news hour today, Lynn and Scott will speak with Dr. Elizabeth Margulis, who examines how music can transport us into vivid inner worlds and what those musical daydreams reveal about their mind. Then, astrophysicist Emma Chapman explores how radio waves reveal the hidden universe and what they can teach us about everything from distant planets to the origin of the cosmos. That's Cool Science Radio, Thursdays in the 9 a.m. hour, here on KPCW. Thousands of people will head to Midway over Memorial Day weekend for the 2026 Soldier Hollow Classic Sheepdog Championship and Festival. Drivers are advised to plan ahead as the festival welcomes competitors from 20 countries and hundreds of sheep and dogs Friday through Monday. At the 2002 Winter Olympic venue, dogs and their handlers will demonstrate herding, agility, and pulling carts for a chance at a championship title. Festivities begin tomorrow at 8 a.m. And KPCW and the Wasatch Record will host a forum for Wasatch County voters to hear from the candidates for sheriff. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has the details.
Wasatch County voters will choose among three Republican candidates for sheriff this June. Wasatch County Emergency Management Director Jeremy Hales, Summit County Detective Eric Maynard, and incumbent Wasatch County Sheriff Jared Rigby. On Wednesday, May 27th, voters can hear from all three at a forum moderated by reporters from KPCW and the Wasatch Record. The forum will be from 6 to 7 p.m. at the Wasatch County Senior Center in Heber City. Candidates will answer questions about transparency and public trust, immigration enforcement, adapting to the county's growth, managing the department's budget, and more. There will also be time for audience questions. Ballots will be mailed June 2nd, and the primary election is June 23rd. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
And for the second year running, the Park City School District will not raise taxes. KPCW's Christine Weller has more on the district's nearly $79 million fiscal year 2027 budget.
Park City School District Business Administrator Randy Upton presented a tentative fiscal year 2027 budget to the Board of Education Tuesday. It totals almost $79 million, about $44 million lower than last year. Upton said the budget doesn't include a tax increase, something the board said it's committed to. To make that possible, Upton and Superintendent Lindsay Huntsman said the district identified $2.5 million in cost-saving options. Those include consolidating jobs and eliminating positions that don't work directly with students. The district will also get about $650,000 from property tax growth and almost $850,000 from the state. As for expenditures, the district has designated about $42 million for its general fund. That supports instruction, counselors, district and school administration, and student transportation. Another $21 million is set aside for capital projects, including ongoing construction at Dozier Field and the Treasure Mountain Sports Complex. While the district won't raise taxes, some taxpayers may still see changes in what they owe. That's because the state has not yet set a basic school levy. Homeowners may also see a bump if their home values increased. The board will approve the final fiscal year 2027 budget at its regular meeting June 16th after a public hearing. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
On the phone with me now is Chris Robinson, Summit County Council member. Good morning.
Good morning, Connor.
So council met yesterday, and much of your meeting Wednesday afternoon was concerned about the 910 Cattle Ranch, specifically the part of the management plan the county's developing around recreation. I think the consensus seems to be that this is one of the ways in which we will have the biggest impact on this property. What were your first impressions of the recreation plan that county staff have drafted?
Well, first off, I thought that Jess Kirby, our director of lands, and has done a great job in doing a lot of outreach and multifaceted plans. This recreation plan is just part of it. There's been countless meetings and engagements. And I think that she's really wise in coming up with what she labels an adaptive plan, which is a phased plan. And she's wanting to get the rules and the systems and some infrastructure in place before turning the key and opening the gate to let everybody in. And because there's been examples such as Bonanza Flat where it's different. Bonanza's different because it had been used by the public a lot before the city acquired it. So there was already a large constituency here. The prior owner, David Bernalfo, kept a pretty tight lid on it, hadn't been used by the public. And now we have the opportunity to, since there's not an existing constituency that's been using it, to get it right from the beginning. And, we paid for three-fourths of it almost with forest legacy money, which was for forest values and wildlife, not necessarily recreation. So we're trying to strike a good balance and start off slowly and work into a phased approach. But I think she's done a great job with the plan. We do need to get public input on it. Unfortunately, our agenda wasn't advertised for such, because I would have really liked to have heard what the public thought of it. But in general, I think it's a really good start.
Sure. For folks who don't know where the property is, it's just north of Jeremy Ranch, but I guess below Jeremy Ranch in elevation in some sense, on the paved road that goes to East Canyon Reservoir. It's the 8,600 acres surrounding that road that makes up the 910. And it seems like county leaders are calling this officially the largest ever property acquisition that Summit County has closed on. You mentioned that 3/4 of this, so $40 million of the $55 million, came from the federal level. And I think there's some sense among councilor staff, as best I can tell from watching these meetings, that when there's public money involved, there's some mandate to allow the public access. But how does the federal money maybe, you know, lessen that mandate?
I think that it lessens it because a lot of, you know, we're very grateful for the money, first of all. We had in our aspirations that we would get a lot of help. It's a miracle that we have the money, that we had this money that we didn't have to use very much, relatively speaking, of taxpayer money, of our Summit County property taxpayer money. So I think there's a lot of things at play here. There's the intent. In the seller's decision to sell to the county, it was predicated a lot on wanting this to be more of a preserve. And he had lots of opportunities to sell to other parties. And he chose us because he thought we were the best suited to make it more of a preserve. That's been added to with the federal forest legacy money and the conservation easement we have there. We do have a lot of latitude. Like Jess mentioned, we could build 65 miles of trails. We're not, you know, when you do an easement, it's forever. So you want to allow yourself a little latitude, you know. But we're starting out small. And I think it's consistent with what our public wants, too. But I'd like to hear it from them. But I think that the public doesn't want it to become a zoo, and we're also trying, a zoo meaning overrun by, you know, too many people.
I think people would like a zoo in the sense of wildlife remaining undisturbed.
I need to use my terminology more judiciously, but I think that you know, we've got some 400 miles of bike paths. Do we need a mountain bike trail every 200 yards on the 910? I don't think so. So she's come up with these three different areas, and 53% of it is this sort of conservation area that will have access, but it's going to be more like the Swanner Nature Preserve, where it's restricted and it's scheduled. It's not, any day of the week I can just go out there and tromp around on the nature preserve at Swanner. Be more like that. But it's subject to change, too. It's not like what we're doing today is fixed in stone forever. We're starting out slow, and we're going to adapt.
That's a good point. How is maybe the recreation management plan different from a conservation easement in terms of who can rewrite it in the future if we have new ideas or things come up that don't work?
Well, the conservation easement is recorded against the property, and it has the Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, the Division of Utah Government, and the USDA as parties. So to amend it, it doesn't require an act of Congress, but it's not many notches below that. The management plan can be amended by the county council at any time.
Yeah.
So it's a lot different.
You mentioned the conservation zone. That's one of the three that County Lands and Natural Resources is thinking of, kind of, these three areas of the ranch, conservation being just over 50% of it, with the least amount of access, the most amount of access in the community zone, and then a portion of the property will be some medium in between those, the exploration zone. You know, what's your thought on that as a framework? Are you familiar with other properties or public lands or state parks or things like that that have tried a sort of tiered approach like that?
I can't say I'm familiar with a tiered approach, but I am somewhat familiar with the geography and the topography out there. So the 53% is basically on the west side of the East Canyon Creek Road. It's dark timber, north slopes, heavily vegetated, and would not be a great place if you had a lot of people and you had a wildfire getting in and out. I mean, it's like Summit Park density, or just heavy timber. It's got lots of conifers, and community area is along the corridor. We have hundreds of people a day using the road, walking dogs and stuff. In the community area that kind of parallels the road and goes up Mill Hollow, we'll have some trails and things that people with dogs and walking and some parking areas so that they don't have to park on the road. That'll be maybe like 5.5 miles of trails there, which will be a real amenity. And then that exploration zone is more on the east side, and that's more of a south-facing slopes, and it doesn't have the heavy vegetation, the conifers and whatnot. It's more oak brush and more open, and so I think it's more amenable also to making trail connections. Like, I think she discussed one possibly going up to Blind Dog, so you could come down, can continue on down and a loop up there. And so I think the way they've looked at the types of vegetation and the slopes and the aspect of the various areas and come up with this plan, I think it's a good start.
How would you describe current conditions on the ranch? There was a little bit of a discussion about the staffing currently, and there's definitely going to be some time, months or years, before it opens to the public, because it's worth mentioning every time we discuss this that the public is not allowed to stray from East Canyon Road right now. So given that, I have no idea what's going on the rest of the land. Are you familiar with any of that right now?
Well, there's been some fencing along Bear Creek. There's been some fuels reduction and forestry management. There's been a lot of studies done of cultural resources and weed surveys and things. I think the idea is that sometime next spring we'd kind of have an opening. And so that I was told that some of these trails and things will be on the Planning Commission's agenda, and I've seen some drawings for them. So there's been some engineering work done on the trails and parking to give us something to celebrate and open with. And I think she was leaning towards sometime next year for that. But in the meantime, we'd appreciate it if people would just use the roadway and not go into the heartland of it.
So when will the public get to comment on, well, they've already kind of gotten to engage with the recreation management plan through an open house, but when will you get to hear from the public about the recreation management plan as it's drafted?
I don't know. I think we need to, I'd like to have a meeting at which the public can comment, but I'm not in charge of the schedule.
All right, moving on to the public hearing last night was related to the community development block grant. I wanted to ask about this because it comes up every year, but it seems like kind of an insider item where tax money is getting allocated to projects, but I never see anyone show up for this. So what is the CDBG for anyone who doesn't know? I mean, can you communicate to residents what they're missing by not showing up?
The acronym stands for the Community Development Block Grant. It's, as I understand it, federal monies that are given to the state to be administered through these block grants. And there's on somebody's checklist, there's a requirement that there be a hearing. You'll note that a public hearing, you'll note that it was after we'd closed our county council meeting and then we opened this special hearing. And Katie Madsen, who's our grant specialist, described that there was one for Peoria. And we opened the public hearing and closed it. And then that was it. And it wasn't any, there wasn't any need for input from the council. None was sought, none was given. And it's usually for water projects or the, in communities that, or you know, or infrastructure within small communities. Well, I've mainly seen it. Peoria has received several to upgrade its water system. Wanship, I think, has received some.
All right. So it's a way if residents, you know, have ideas for infrastructure in their community that needs help, they might want to give public input next spring.
I think the time the public input is sought, the die has been cast. I think it would, most of the communities know about the process and put in for grants, and then it goes through a vetting process. And what you saw last night is the very tail end of that process, where a box is being checked. Yeah, we've had a public hearing. If for some reason there was something egregious that was being proposed, that public hearing may have stopped it. But in my tenure, it's a pretty perfunctory thing.
All right. Just because I saw you at the county's speaker series on Tuesday, I wanted to ask what you thought of it. It was focused on water and the current drought and the hot summer ahead, and the moderator said the Salt Lake is toast. He thinks it's going to collapse this year. I mean, what's your reaction to that? It's kind of alarming.
I think that he was being a little bit exaggerating. The lake is down at 4192. It's a foot and a half lower than where it was last year. The good news is that when it reached its low a few years ago, it got to 4188, but there was a serious hypersaline condition that doesn't exist today the way the state's been managing the north and south arms. It's going to get low. There's been lots of efforts to try to prop it up and divert some waters to it, but it has a big appetite for water where it's evaporating a million or 2 acre feet. But I haven't written it off, but it's going to be tough. But I thought the panel discussion was great. And I think that, you know, we're lucky to have Weber Basin as a partner in Snyderville Basin and the whole county, because we've set things in motion that will allow us to have the necessary water. And we do a good job in the basin with using water for our households and businesses and things. We're pretty efficient.
All right, Chris, I think we have to leave it there. Anything else you need to mention?
No, thanks a lot, Connor.
Thanks for calling in. That's Summit County Councilmember Chris Robinson recapping yesterday's county council meeting. Here in the studio, we have Park City School District Superintendent Lindsay Huntsman, and on the line, Board Member Meredith Reed. Thank you both for coming in this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so we had the board meeting this week on Tuesday, I believe, and a calendar change was approved. Starting this fall, freshmen will start a day earlier than the rest of the high schoolers. Why did the district want to make that change?
Yeah, so as we've reached this first year with freshmen in the high school, we recognize freshman year is the most critical make-or-break year in a student's educational trajectory. And there are studies that show ninth grade attendance and grades are significantly more predictive of high school graduation than socioeconomic economic background, race, or standardized testing. So we want our freshmen to come into the school without the 10th and 12th graders, lower that affective filter, help them to create relationships with our high school teachers and get to know the building. The building can be quite scary as you transition from 8th to 9th grade. So we really just want all hands on deck so our freshmen feel safe and strategically positioned to have a successful first year of high school.
Yeah, because they're all coming from Ecker now. They're not so close, and it's a bigger building than before.
Correct.
So, you know, you mentioned kind of what the goals are. It won't be classes then. It'll be sort of an orientation type day.
Yeah, so we're in the early stages of planning that. Principal Fine and his team are scheduling out what that day might look like. Students will still arrive at the typical start time, 7:30, and move through the day until 2:25, but it won't be your typical school day. There'll be activities, meet and greets with their teachers, and then just that orientation into the high school, what to expect, whether it's grading, attendance, behavior expectations, the yonder pouches, as well as the lunch schedule. Now that we've transitioned to a single lunch, because they will be accustomed to two lunches at Ecker Hill, and the high school only has one lunch.
You know, and Meredith, I want to get you in this conversation as well about scheduling, since the board put one of the proposals on hold that was earlier release times for the elementary and middle school, if I'm correct. Why the hesitation, and maybe Lindsay, we can go to you about why what the proposal is.
Right. I think we just wanted to give our parents a little more notice on that because it was a change for elementary school kids. But the possibility for impacting them was just higher, and we want to make sure that we're communicating well with our parents and that they understand what's happening and it's not just something out of the blue. So older kids can flex a little bit more easily with changes like that, but it's a little more challenging for our parents.
Yeah, Lindsay, what do you see as the advantages of that earlier release for those age groups?
Yeah, so it's twofold, right? Looking at it from a staffing perspective, as we held listening tours with my executive leadership team this spring, a consistent theme arose at each building is teachers and staff need more time. And so as we entered the negotiations process with our different employee groups, it was brought forth to us that there was a discrepancy in the time that staff had on Fridays between high school, elementary, and middle school. So what this shift does is gives back approximately 45 minutes to staff at Ecker Hill and approximately 20 minutes back to staff at elementary schools. If you do the math over the course of the school year, you know, that's multiple hours that they're giving back to prep, plan, and work collaboratively with their teams.
All right, so that should come back at maybe next board meeting for a vote?
Yes, we're crafting a survey right now along with a one-pager that explains the why and then the adjustments to the end times on Friday. Again, this is Friday only. We're not looking at Monday through Thursday. And the times specifically are dedicated to give that 40-minute window to our bus drivers because they need 40 minutes from site to site.
Yeah, and as we've previously reported, there is no proposed property tax increase in the fiscal year 27 budget. Meredith, why is that a priority for the board right now?
I think the board's just very attuned to how the challenges of, you know, across the board for the economic landscape in our community, you know, in our country, in our community, especially older members of our community, people who've been here a long time. We really are looking for ways to find efficiencies in the budget. That's what Lindsay and Randy have certainly taken that to heart and are, understand that priority. And we want to make sure that we're delivering the best possible products across the board of education and to our teachers, to our community within the budget constraints that we have right now.
Lindsay, did you have to make any cuts to make that happen for next year?
So we did not enter a reduction in force. As people have moved on, whether that's retirement or they're pursuing another opportunity, we're evaluating the need of that position based on declining enrollment. It's no secret we've been declining in enrollment since 2016. When we were at the height of our enrollment, we were just over 4,800 kids. And now we're just over 4,000. We recognize that there's an enrollment bubble in our secondary schools. The current senior class is sitting at 370 students, but our kindergarten class is sitting at 228. So we're trying to be thoughtful and have foresight to look into the future. And as people move on, to avoid that reduction in force, be strategic about where we backfill those positions and where can we absorb.
That's a pretty significant difference. And like, usually how many of those kindergartners will end up at, say, a private high school in Salt Lake?
It's interesting that you bring that up. More often than not, they return to us if they've entered a charter school or private school in their K-8 experience. They typically come back to us for their high school experience.
Okay. So I'm curious, because it's not like not going through a tax increase each year means you get the same amount of money as the previous year, but I'm not very well educated on this. I'm asking about the weighted pupil unit, which I understand is a very technical behind-the-scenes budgeting term for the school people, and it changes the amount of money that you get each year based on your enrollment. Is that too simple? Can you kind of get into the weeds there for me?
Yeah, for us, it doesn't generate a lot of new revenue. So even though the WPU will be at 4.2% next year, that only generates approximately $700,000 for us. So when you look at the grand scheme of our budget, that's not a lot of money. Just this fiscal year alone, we are sending back approximately $34 million back to the state as part of recapture and equalization. So I think it's important to understand, like, a lot of what we are able to do is due to our tax base.
Okay, so that policy you mentioned is sort of a redistribution of money from the wealthier school districts to the, usually the rural ones have less funding due to enrollment. Is the weighted pupil unit the way that the state divvies up that money, or is it kind of a separate pot?
There's multiple funding mechanisms, so it's not just a simple answer that's straightforward. There are multiple ways in which school districts receive money, both from the state and the federal government.
All right. And as usual, the board got its construction update. Lindsay, where are the Dozier Field and Treasure Mountain sports projects at?
Yeah, so major construction is expected to be substantially completed around early August. Specific to Dozier, we have scheduled the first couple of football games away in the event we run into some unforeseen items that need attention. There will be some cosmetic cleanup and landscaping that will continue beyond August, but we're optimistic that the athletic fields will be complete at Dozier come early August, just in time for fall sports.
All right. On the Treasure Mountain side, there was the news back in October that the contractor there illegally dumped water. So since then, groundwater has been kept on site until the right state permit is acquired. What's the status of that permitting?
Yeah, so we have the treated groundwater and surface water permit. DWQ was actually on site a couple weeks ago to conduct an inspection. We received their report about 2 weeks ago, and there were no violations identified. Currently, there is some sludge sediment material within those frac tanks. That material is being handled separately and hauled off site through the appropriate process. You will notice if you drive past the site, there are a few remaining frac tanks of clean water that need to be managed. That testing has been sent off. We're awaiting those results. Once we receive those results and they are within the limits, then we'll complete that dewatering process.
And with the permit acquired, does the water just go into the creek anyway, or where has some of the stuff with the heavy metals in it gone?
Yeah, there's a process that they treat it, and then it is discharged.
Okay.
And it has to be within a certain limit before it's discharged.
You know, there have been questions about the soils and the excavation on the property and whether the district is following its agreement with the EPA. Are you following it?
Yeah, I think the key to that question is that we are and always have been following the direction and guidance provided by DEQ and DIR. And they act on behalf of the EPA in consultation with our environmental consultant.
My understanding is that piles that are on the property right now, you know, there are different amounts of metals in there, and there are different rules for particular piles. You know, one of them has failed the test that, you know, determines how safe it is regarding water leaching into the ground. What are the district's options for addressing that one pile, if I'm correct about that? And what is your timeline for addressing that pile?
Yeah, so I think it's important to note that the 90 days only applies to that one pile that didn't meet the TCLEP test. And the TCLEP, as you mentioned, is the toxicity characteristic leaching procedure. This process determines if contaminated soil should be classified as hazardous waste. All other piles have until the end of construction, since they're being incorporated back into the ground or as landscape berms. And that 90-day window can be extended, and it doesn't begin until after the soil has been characterized.
So that one pile, where will it go after this? And where are you in the 90 days? Because when was that pile created?
So it was characterized on February 23rd. Again, that 90-day window can be extended. We have applied for a bevel exemption, and we hope to have a decision within the next day or two as to whether or not that bevel exemption has been granted.
You're using the term of art characterized. What does that mean?
Characterized is whether or not it's hazardous waste, and it's exceeded those thresholds that have been designated.
So it's the test?
Correct.
Okay. And anything else before we go that y'all want to mention today?
I just want to celebrate our staff, our students, our community. We are seeing RISE scores come in higher than we have previously. Those who aren't familiar with RISE, that is the end of year assessment that our third through eighth graders take. Aspire testing at the high school for ninth and 10th grades. We're seeing scores that we've never seen before in the history of Park City High School. That's specific to academics. I want to celebrate our girls' golf team. They recently won the first state title in school history, and wish our girls' LAX team, lacrosse team, who plays later today for the state championship, a ton of luck. We've been able to achieve and reach milestones this year, and that would not be possible with our staff and the support of our community and the great work our students do on a daily basis.
All right. We've been speaking with Park City School District Superintendent Lindsay Huntsman and Board Member Meredith Reed. Thank you both for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks, Connor.
And calling in from the Utah Highway Safety Office on the line now, we have Carrie Forer. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So the reason we wanted to have you on is it's Memorial Day coming up, and that begins a particularly, statistically speaking, dangerous time on Utah's roads, referred to widely as the 100 deadliest days. Can you speak to that danger and why this is so dangerous, I guess?
Yes. So the 100 deadliest days, that covers the period between Memorial Day and Labor Day, when traffic fatalities historically spike in Utah. And typically we see about one death per day on Utah roads during that time period. And so we're just asking every Utahn to make safe choices every time they get behind the wheel. And that means choosing to buckle up every trip, every seat, every ride, choosing to drive calm and not engage in road rage, choosing to drive at safe speeds for conditions and obey the speed limits, choosing to put your phone down and not drive distracted, and choose a sober ride. If you drink, don't drive.
Yeah, I'm curious, can you break down some of the numbers of what the causes of the crashes between Memorial Day and Labor Day are? And is there something about the summer that makes those causes more likely or worse?
Yeah, so with summer means increased travel and vehicles on Utah roads, and that gives us more traffic, which can lead to more crashes. And our office, we study the crash trends and what causes these. We find that 64% were speed related, and over one third involved a driver using drugs or alcohol. So what's causing these crashes? There's contributing factors. Those include failure to keep in the proper lane of travel, failure to yield the right of way, running off the road, overcorrecting, and driving too fast for conditions. And many of those factors go back to unsafe speeds or driver distraction.
You know, you're on the radio. This is part of education for the 100 deadliest days, I suppose. But what other methods is the Department of Public Safety using to, you know, reduce some of these numbers?
Right now, we have our DUI enforcement blitz taking place, where over 36 police agencies and the Utah Highway Patrol are working additional overtime shifts to enforce impaired driving. And then also we've got our Click It or Ticket seatbelt campaign, where we have increased enforcement with officers looking for unbelted drivers and passengers, really with the goal of safety in mind. They want everyone to arrive to their destination safely and to drive safely and make good choices.
And
We also have our paid media campaigns that run all summer long to educate the public about our vulnerable roadway users, pedestrians, bicyclists, and motorcycles. And then, of course, the dangers of driving impaired and the importance of buckling up with Click It or Ticket campaign.
That actually segues into what I should have asked about before, which is what types of vehicles do you see have issues during the summer? We're seeing more and more powerful e-bikes, especially near our station. It's frequently teens on these vehicles with less road experience. Do you have a sense for who the 100 deadliest days are most dangerous for?
Yes, you're exactly right. It's teens. The largest age group represented in these crashes are teen drivers. We've got 22% of these crashes involving teens, and 42% of the crashes involved younger drivers under the age of 29. Younger drivers, they're more prone to unsafe speeds and distractions, and also just have less experience behind the wheel, which can lead to these types of crashes.
The rules are changing, and there will be more restrictions as far as e-bikes, some being considered motorcycles now. As part of your data collection, are you going to be able to tell how certain legislative changes affect the safety of the citizens during the summer?
Yes, over time, we are tracking crashes involving electric mobility devices, and then also motorcycles crashes. We track that as well. We know that motorcycle fatalities are on the rise and have been over the last couple of years. And then with the e-mobility devices, that's an emerging trend where we're seeing a spike in crashes. And that's something that we're getting set up for to track with our crash report forms on the electric and their involvement in those types of crashes. So we'll be able to track that closer in the next coming years ahead with that.
All right.
But I feel like, the law that's just been recently put into place for e-mobility devices is really going to address a lot of those safety concerns, mandatory helmets for people under the age of 21 and of course, a safety course that will be adopted next year that will be required for kids ages 8 to 15. And then just increased education and awareness overall, we hope will help reduce those crashes.
And I want to kind of reiterate some of the causes that we started with and maybe some of the solutions, because in some cases, they're quite simple. If you're impaired, don't drive. If you're speeding, slow down. What other tips do you have for people to stay safe just in terms of individual decision-making?
Just to really plan out your trip, make sure that you're making good choices. Every decision you make behind the wheel carries a consequence for you, for the people you share the road with, and the family waiting for you to come home. So making sure that your vehicle safe, tire pressure, all of that you're ready to drive and alert. You're not driving fatigued after working a night shift. You're choosing not to drive distracted, cell phones down, wearing your seat belts, adhering to speed limits. All of those make a huge difference and impact the safety of everyone around you.
How long have you been doing some of the initiatives you mentioned of ad campaigns, education, some of these enforcement blitzes on particularly dangerous weekends? And have you seen any effect on the amount of crashes or, say, tickets?
Zero Fatalities has been operating for, probably 15, 20 years. And the only acceptable goal on our roadways is zero fatalities. We are seeing a slight downward trend in the total number of crashes. That did spike over the pandemic. With 2019, we had the lowest total fatalities in the last decade, but the pandemic brought a huge spike in poor traffic behavior nationwide, not only just in Utah. But just more recently, we're seeing a slightly downward trend in overall total crashes. So that's the good news. We continue to just focus on raising awareness of those five deadliest behaviors that we see on Utah's roads, and you know, just that call to action to ask drivers to calm drive or to drive calm, focused, alert, sober, and buckled.
All right. Anything else you want to mention?
Just encourage everyone to drive safe. Remind them that their choices carry consequences. And if you know, you choose to drive safe and buckle up and alert, hopefully you're setting that example for others in your vehicle, and we can just continue that safety culture that we're trying to promote in our state.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Carrie. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Carrie Forrest. She's the deputy director of the state's Highway Safety Office. Getting into a little bit of local news, the Park City Council is considering giving itself a hefty raise. KPCW's Christine Weller reports salary increases set for discussion today would also apply to the mayor.
Park City Council and mayor salaries could more than double for fiscal year 2027. City staff is proposing the increases to put compensation packages in line with other elected officials in Summit County. The mayor's salary would increase from more than $55,000 to almost $117,000. Councilor salaries would increase from nearly $29,000 to more than $58,000. City Manager Adam Lenhard said outside of periodic cost of living adjustments, the elected officials haven't had compensation package increases since fiscal year 2015. But the councilor and mayor jobs have become more demanding.
Any current or previous elected official could speak to the demands of the position. I would say that those demands have increased over time. The mayor, in particular, is the chief executive officer of the city.
The compensation packages for Park City elected officials, including health care premium increases, total almost $596,000. The council will also consider bumping up city staff salaries. The increases are between 0 and 2% for cost of living adjustments and up to 4% for merit-based bonuses. Before the city council considers approving any raises, locals can weigh in during two public hearings.
The beauty of this item is that, you know, these decisions aren't made in a vacuum, but they are subject to a public process. It ensures that these conversations happen in public.
The decisions will help city staff finalize the fiscal year 2027 budget, which the council is set to adopt June 11th. The city's general revenue fund projection, which reflects the cost of running core city services, sits at $57.7 million. That's compared to about $56.3 million for fiscal year 2026. Also on the council agenda for Thursday is a possible vote on an ordinance meant to increase commercial recycling. The council may also approve a contract to add parking signage along the Marsac corridor and a new bus shelter on the Purple Bus route. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
And in Heber, the city council awarded over $119,000 in grants to support local trails, arts, and parks projects. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports leaders want to increase the proportion of arts funding in future grant cycles.
Every year, Heber City awards grant funding for projects that support creativity and outdoor recreation in the community. The money comes from the Trails, Arts, and Parks, or TAP tax, which voters approved in 2022. At the Heber City Council meeting Tuesday, leaders voted to provide grants to projects ranging from musical theater performances to art classes at the Senior Center. A full list of projects is available at kpcw.org. The council also discussed whether a larger share of the top tax revenue should be dedicated to the arts. So far, the city has set aside 10% of the money for arts grants, with recommendations coming to the council after applications are reviewed by the Arts Advisory Committee. The other 90% of the top tax revenue is used for trails and parks projects. Heber City's Parks, Open Space, Trails and Trees Advisory Committee recommends projects to the council for funding.
That's KPCW's Grace Dorfler reporting. Council members did express interest in raising the amount of arts funding out of that proportion to 15%.